refrain, this repeated refrain from Psalm 19, that the law of the Lord gives life. It makes wise the simple. It rejoices the heart and enlightens the eyes. Now, I suspect every one of us longs for these things naturally, for life and for light, for wisdom, for joy in the heart. But I'll wager that none of us, except for maybe one or two people with some pet concerns, wakes up in the morning and reads the law of the Old Testament expecting joy and light and wisdom in life. This has got to be the most boring and disinteresting part of Scripture. I read the Psalms. They're way more exciting than the law, right? We get this saying, we hear it, we know Psalm 19 and these refrains from Psalm 119. Oh, how I love your law. It is my meditation all the day. It makes me wiser than my enemies, for your commandments are ever with me. But none of us, I suspect, if you were to be honest, actually believes that. Or does our conduct reveal that that's true of us? We don't wake up and think, I'm going to sit down and read through Leviticus today. I need to be picked up, a little joy in my life. We have this disconnect with law. And so it makes it difficult for us to hear this psalm honestly, I think, and understand it. So we get this saying with the Decalogue in our reading today in the middle of Lent. And we revisit this law and see how it is, perhaps, that the psalmist could say these things about the law and believe that it gave light and life and wisdom to those who read it. Well, big picture, this Decalogue is a unique piece of law. You know that. It's the only law in the Old Testament given face-to-face to the people of Israel. The rest of the law was given to Moses on the mountain by himself, and he wrote it. This one is written by the finger of God on the stones in front of the people. And then it's placed in the Ark of the Covenant that travels before Israel. The rest of the 600 laws of Israel are written on a scroll and put outside the Ark, inside the Holy of Holies. And the Ten Commandments come to symbolize this memorable core of the law. They don't replace these other commandments. They structure them, they outline them, they anticipate the framework of an ordered society before God. The early church, within the first 2 centuries of Jesus, within 100 years, had already adopted the Ten Commandments as its way of worship and catechesis for teaching and instruction. And it became, with the Lord's Prayer, 2 fixed moments in the Sunday liturgy for Eucharist, to pray these commands together and to pray the Lord's Prayer. And you might think that the Reformers got rid of all that, the law that we're supposed to be free from. The truth of the Bible is grace, is it not, after all? But Cranmer and Luther and Calvin, the 3 major works of the Reformation, all put the Decalogue in their service of worship. And all of them used it for training and catechesis. I know David's in the middle of an Anglican training program now, and I think he plans to spend 2 or 3 weeks on the Decalogue, preparing us to study these things as the church has. My point is simply this. Paul, who delights in the law and his inward being, does not discourage us from reading this law for wisdom. The church that is Protestant, that is about grace, does not discourage us from reading these laws as a source of wisdom and light. I suggest it's something else. It's only in the last 100 years that the Decalogue has come out of worship services, ours to be named among them. We read the summary of the law, which is a break from hundreds of years of history, because it's simpler, it's nicer. Does it make you feel bad? It gets the service running a little bit quicker. But we miss this ancient historic practice of looking through these Ten Commands and imagining the world the way the church invited us to. So I want to bring us back into this Decalogue and learn how we might read it. 3 points about these 10 words. I should just add to that that in the Hebrew, there are 10 words. It's never called commands. They're suggestions. They're sayings that open up a vision of life. First point, the ordered life is a good life. The ordered life is a good life. Maybe that seems obvious to you. Our culture tests this over and over again. Amy and I have these conversations. She meets with students regularly who can't get out of bed. They have no sleep hygiene. They stall behind in their classes. They're not turning in their assignments. They look a wreck because they do not believe that the ordered life is the good life. They're testing what their parents have taught them. Going to bed and getting your homework done and doing your job for a number of students in that stage of life is testing this very principle. And they'll find by the time they're 30, they'll have fallen into the pattern that their parents laid down for them, because the ordered life is a good life. If you're like me, I'm following this news for the last several years of the legalization of illicit drugs in San Francisco, in Seattle, in Portland. And the cities, if you know them, are an utter disaster. Addiction, death, crime, truancy, trafficking. Yesterday, Oregon lifted its law to go back to penalize drug use. The ordered life is the good life. We strain against it, we fight against it sometimes, but we know this is true. We don't let our children decide when to go to bed at night and what to eat and what to go to school or not. We give them certain kinds of structures and order because it brings about flourishing and goodness in their life. Much as we might sometimes doubt it or wonder at it, the ordered life is the good life. Law prohibits life and freedom. I'm here now trusting that nobody's stealing my car or breaking into my home. I have a freedom to be about the city because the law gives me provisions for an ordered and good life. Second, the law of God was the revelation of the Lord in time of the good and ordered life. It was the guide and the means for Israel to live in an orderly way. It's those instructions we give to our children about how to protect themselves from their own dangers. The law framed an ordered life. Psalm 19 beautifully puts this to us. The sun runs its course from one end of the heavens to the other, rejoicing to do its work. It has a course and a path. It has a job. It has a time that it sleeps and a time that it rises, and it delights in the order of its world, to which the psalmist turns. The law of the Lord is perfect, making for human life or refreshing the soul. The law has that power within it to order life, to bring about structures of community and society and personal behavior that make us ordered. We read today, I asked Martha last week to change the Decalogue. We had the version that's in Exodus, but I moved it to the one in Deuteronomy, which we'll have again in June. But today, in the middle of Lent, I thought it important to read the second version because it's later and it's about 10% longer. And it makes six major changes to the version that is in Exodus. And it begins to illumine for us the way that this law wasn't a set of just basic commands that you kept and checked a box. They were the basis for Israel imagining the morally ordered good life. I'll just share three of these changes that the law makes. The first one, maybe the most obvious, most everyone recognizes, it's a change to the Sabbath law. It extends it, nearly doubles the length of it. In Exodus, you keep the Sabbath because the Lord your God made the heavens and the earth in 6 days, and on the seventh day he rested. In Exodus, the principle of rest is based on the created order of the world. There's a fabric and an order to the sun and to the clouds, to animals that go out and pray at night and sleep during the day. There's an order to the way we live. And Israel is invited into that in Exodus to work and find rest. Deuteronomy, though, changes that law and says, "For you were slaves in Egypt, and I brought you out with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm." The basis for keeping the Sabbath is that you were people who had no rest, and I've given you rest. Rest becomes not just God's ordering of the world, but his gift. He is not a ruler who does not care for his people. He tends to their needs. In the vision of the law is a Lord above it who cares for the benefits of his people. Deuteronomy makes a second major change in the second half of this law. Exodus says, you and your male servant and female servant and your livestock. But Israel says this, you and your ox and your donkey and all your cattle and your male and female servant and the sojourner, that they may rest as well as you. That they may rest as well as you. The Sabbath becomes the basis of a cooperative society, of trust. Exodus teaches us the Lord has ordered the world in a certain way. Deuteronomy says, I owe certain practices of trust and life and balance to my neighbor and to the creation. It is the basis for an organized society, that a community of people would agree at risk to their own economy to set aside work that all may find renewal, that all may share in the benefits of worship and fellowship and feasting. Deuteronomy begins to build the vision of a good society, of public trust, of social bonds, of a king who's bound to the priests, the judges who order and judge the laws for the people. There is a society that functions by trust, that orders itself well with life for all. The second command that it changes is the ninth command. They're not commands and they're not numbered, and so some orderings of the law will have, this is the eighth command. And it's the one that says, you shall not bear false witness against your neighbor, which is not what it says. That's what Exodus says. You shall not answer falsely against your neighbor. And the most likely context for the law in Exodus is one of the courtroom. Any accusation of law in the ancient world of this kind was brought before judges with two or three witnesses that had to bring a charge of guilt. You think of Naboth's vineyard, where they rise up false witnesses to accuse Naboth and steal his vineyard. The law required witnesses, and so the law prohibits you from testifying falsely. That's the word, falsely. But Deuteronomy changes the word. You shall not answer in vain or empty to your neighbor. Think about that change. For one, it's the exact same word as in the third commandment. You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in an empty way. It's vague. It's broad. What would it mean to use the Lord's name in vain? It could mean all kinds of things. In effect, what Deuteronomy does by changing this word to a much broader term, it opens up the morality and the power of speech. I can harm my neighbor by false testimony, but I can harm them by slander, by abuse, by gossip, by blaming. Paul, no doubt, who'd meditated on these most of his life, has these many refrains in his letters. Let no unwholesome word come out of your mouth, but only such as is good for the moment, that it may bring grace to those who hear. Deuteronomy has this seed of a vision of good speech, of words that come out of our mouths that bless my neighbor, that are not only honest, but true. The third change that Deuteronomy makes, the third of six, is to the final commandment. The version in Exodus says this, you shall not covet your neighbor's house or your neighbor's wife or your neighbor's male servant or female servant. It begins with house, but Deuteronomy reorders the law and it says this, you shall not covet your neighbor's wife and, second paragraph, you shall not desire your neighbor's house or your neighbor's male servant or female servant or his ox or his donkey or his cattle. If you see the change, it's evident in the language. A new paragraph has been added, and the woman has been removed from the property of the house to be a law of her own. Catholic and Jewish versions will make these two separate laws if you've come from those traditions. One law of no coveting of the neighbor's wife, one of his house and his property. Marriage stands out as a place of protection and dignity. It parallels the commandment for the Sabbath of mutual trust. I flourish if you don't covet my wife. And you flourish if I don't covet yours. There's a harmony and a trust that's built into this community. We single out obligations. I raise these examples within the law simply to lift our minds or our imaginations from the idea that there were just these 600 commands that the Israelites were to run around keeping blindly. They were, in fact, a vision for life. They were adapted through Israel's history, constantly being modified to bring about justice and flourishing in new times and new places. The good life is an ordered life. The law of God is His own interpretation of His creation for flourishing at a point in time. But third, it should be obvious to us, this point that's hanging in the backdrop, the law of the Lord is not complete. It doesn't solve all of humanity's problems. This is Paul's chief argument in Romans 7. The law is good, it is spiritual, it is holy. I delight in it in the inward man. But it cannot put to death the deeds of the flesh. For I find at work within me the sin that goes about doing the very thing I hate. The law has no power to bring life out of death. It is a guide, it has wisdom, it has an ordered moral vision, but it cannot take this flesh of mine that continues to do what I do not want it to do and spring it into goodness and life. I think there's something of that very much going on in John's gospel passage with Jesus going in and washing out the tables of crime and of abuse in the temple at the festival, of people making profit from selling goods for sacrifices at the Passover. And they ask for a sign, which the law requires if Jesus is going to make a point. So the sign that he gives them is this: tear this temple down, and in 3 days I'll give you a new one. The sign comes true, the prophet is to be listened to, the law says. Jesus knows this law. And he knows that the temple and the sacrifices and the killing of animals, as we see in the book of Hebrews, cannot bring life out of sin. Christ will become the living temple. He will take our bodies and die to the sin that weighs us down. And he will become life for us. It is the limitation of the law to bring about life. Christ himself is the end of the law. He's the one who keeps the law on our behalf and makes us righteous. And so the law can only point in promise of a future day when God would indeed deliver us from our sins. But here's a second one. That one is obvious to us, but there's a second way that the law is weak that we tend not to think of, or a limitation to the law, is that it's only a pointer. It can't answer every moral problem. It's a guide. We call it a heuristic. It shows us how to live. The Sabbath teaches me about trust, but it doesn't show me how to live out every area of trust in life. And I think we overlook this about Jesus, that not only is Jesus the one who keeps the law for us, he's the one who teaches the Christian how to read it again for life and for wisdom and for light. Think about Jesus as he walks about in his public life, as we find him in his Gospels. He's an expert law reader. He goes about on the Sabbath day after day, healing the sick. Why would he do this? He could have waited a day. These aren't exceptions to the Sabbath. This is the meaning of the Sabbath: to loose the bonds of the afflicted, to heal the sick, to feed the hungry. Jesus was an expert reader of the law. He knew by getting in their faces and healing on the Sabbath, they would be stuck with their shallow moral vision. And he teaches us about the vision of Sabbath by healing on that day. Jesus is an expert law when they bring to him a woman caught in adultery. And he knows how to get her off of a false accusation or catch them not completing the law as it's meant to be, bringing the man with her. Jesus knows that the Pharisees, our scribes, are whitewashed tombs, hypocrites. They tithe mint and dill and cumin, but forsake the weightier matters of the law. How did Jesus know there were weightier matters of the law if he didn't read it for wisdom and for life and for light? So here's what I'm suggesting to us today as we think about the law and we find ourselves distanced from it. The church has put it here in the middle of Lent as we prepare ourselves for the Feast of Easter. Called by God not only to find life in Him, but to ask Him to be our help to live ordered lives day to day. To be like Jesus in the world where we inhabit. Jesus teaches us how to look through the law to His own reading of it, for eyes to hit the horizon of need, of purity, and of life, to look on the world in new ways and order it for justice and for goodness, for welcome and for joy. So I invite us today in this season of Lent to receive these laws, to allow them to penetrate deeply and show us where we have strayed, and to ask with God's Spirit to teach us and guide us to walk in paths of light again. Amen.
Let's stand together.